When I was about 15 or 16, before I'd actually made contact with the order, maybe even before I'd read about Buddhism, I'm not quite sure, I wrote out a kind of fantasy. It was just a kind of fantasy short, well, it wasn't really a story, but a short piece that I just wrote. I used to like writing stories in those days, sort of fantasies. And the fantasy was of a group of purple-robed monks, simple woolen purple robes, making their way into a bare stone chapel. And all of them were very thin. They were very ascetic looking. They all had bald heads. They were shaved or tonsured, maybe. And they were walking and chanting in a place of rock and stone. It was all quite grey and cold. I can remember that image quite strongly. And the chapel was completely bare except for a rough-hewn wooden cross on a stone altar at the end of the chapel. And at the centre of the cross was a huge clear jewel, like a crystal or a diamond, and very, very brilliant. And the monks stood before the cross, and the leader of these monks began a kind of chant in English, and all the other monks joined in. It was a kind of litany, line after line, and each line began with "I believe," etc. I can't remember all the causes, or indeed any of the causes. I mean, it wasn't the creed or anything like that. It was another kind of my own creed, I suppose. And at a certain point, you know, at the end of this litany, light began to stream from the jewel at the centre, very powerful stream of light streaming from the centre of this cross, pouring into the monks, transporting them to a higher level of consciousness. I can't remember what happened next in that story. The adolescent fantasy that I wrote down all those years ago has long since been thrown out with my school books. And I'd forgotten about this until this morning, actually, when we were talking in our group about our relation to the order. And I remembered just before I started to speak, this little adolescent fantasy that I'd had. And it wasn't that long after that I found the Dharma, that I found the order. My first contact with the Dharma after reading about the Dharma was with the order in the form of Buddhadasa in Brighton. And not long after that, I was ordained into the Western Buddhist Order, what we now call the Triratna Buddhist Order. And I found it very interesting to reflect on that fantasy. Certainly, I think that fantasy was an expression, you know, thinking back to that age, 15 and 16. So it was certainly an expression of a very deep longing to live a spiritual life. But what's interesting about it is that I saw it as something that involved others. I saw it as something collective as well as individual. You know, the litany that I wrote out was "I believe," even though it was chanted by all of the monks. It wasn't "we believe," so there was something individual to it. And there was also that relationship to a symbol embodying that higher dimension, and that symbol and the light from that symbol streaming down into the monks, although there was a cross. I mean, I was raised a Christian. I don't think it was the only kind of central image I think that I knew at the time. So I think that's why the cross was there. But it was the jewel that was the thing. So this memory of this little fantasy is significant for me. The fact that I remembered writing in it, and I was really vividly imagining this little incident. And it's significant to me because in many ways it describes the way I see the order, the Triratna Buddhist Order. I suppose even at that young age, even in the midst of the confusion of adolescence, there was already some connection with a myth, what you might call the myth or a myth of the order, of an order. And perhaps that myth was beginning to express itself in that little story, leading to me to actually find the order, our order, this order, and devote my life to it. And I want to make it clear right at the start of this talk that the order for me, and I know for others too, is not an organisation. I've never regarded the order as an organisation. I've never regarded it as an ecclesiastical body, or I've never regarded it as a religious group. It's never been any of those things to me. And I found myself saying in my reporting in this morning that from quite early on, I felt the order to exist on two planes, as it were, two interconnected planes. It's almost as if there's, as it were, two orders in relationship to one another. There's first of all the order manifesting in time and place that has a history. There are key dates and facts to that history. Sam was saying that his dissertation, is it a dissertation or is it grander than that, is going to be on 1968 and the founding of the Western Buddhist Order, was it in the post-colonial era, something like that. Fantastic. So we're going to get the history with you know, I'm sure it'll be very interesting too from Sam. So that's all very important. So there is what is happening now, what has happened in time, the different friendships, the gatherings, the meetings, the experiences. Each week there is the chapter meeting. Every few months there are the order weekends. Every couple of years there are international order conventions and so on. We can describe these things, these structures, these interactions and so on. There are the ups and downs, the delights and joys of being in this order, the inspirations, the challenges, as well as the conflicts, the errors, the struggles and pains that go on between people. There is that order, concrete, down to earth, even earthbound sometimes. But as well as that, I think I've always sensed, not very clearly and not that consciously, another order, kind of hovering above this order, so to speak. If you like, an ideal order. And I'm using the word ideal, not in a remote, abstract, even sort of oppressive sense. I mean it as something alive and vibrant. I suppose you could say it's a kind of quality of consciousness and being, perhaps. A dimension, a force even, of complete harmony, oneness, egolessness, in which there is transcendence of self and other, which is not personal, but not impersonal in a sort of cold, abstract sense, transpersonal, whatever that means, something shared, something we participate in, something we draw on, where there is uniqueness, particularity, individuality, which is at the same time in which everything is in perfect harmony with everything and everybody else. There is that order as well, which wants to make itself known, and which I'm also trying to reach, of course, with others. And sometimes there is a coming together of these two orders. I've especially experienced this, I think, in pujas, in large order gatherings, a sense of something vast, vaster than all of us, vaster than the sum of our parts, and yet everybody is shining in their particularity. And it's interesting, I've experienced that most vividly in puja, in that ritual context, if you like, in that living out of the myth. And it's that vision, I think, that intuition of the sort of second order, the ideal order, that keeps me going, that's inspired me over the years and drawn me on through all the ups and downs, especially when the order, down here as it were, order members, including myself, have not been behaving like order members at all. Somewhere there's always been some faith, some sense of not being defined by the problems, by the difficulties, that there's something else that's really going on, that we're striving for. Obviously, this sense of two, as it were, orders isn't something that I've made up. It probably comes as much as my own sort of intuitions from picking up on the way Bhante has over the years referred to the order. Sometimes when he refers to the order, he seems to be very much evoking the ideal as though it's there. You know, you sometimes find this in some of his passages, like I think in the Ten Pillars, he says something like, well, there's no question within the order of anybody taking the not given. That's impossible. And the common ownership is the ideal within the order. Everything is shared by order members. And it's clear that he's talking about the ideal state of the order. Sometimes when he talks about the order, he's being intensely practical. Sometimes when, you know, about the actual things we need to do here and now and in the future to create the order. Sometimes he's pointing to strengths. Sometimes he's very definitely pointing to failings. And when you hear Bhante talking about the order, it's important to sense the level in which he's talking about the order, the level on which he is speaking. It's very important to sense that, to tune into that. And he has, of course, said things which suggest, you know, this way of looking at these two different orders. There's this remarkable, very personal confession in my relation to the order, which somebody picked up on this morning. He's saying that he's under no illusions that he's not the best person to have started a new Buddhist order. And he means that. There's no false modesty there. He means that, looking at his own particular personality and all the rest of it. And he goes on to say, I spoke of my having taken upon myself the onerous responsibility of founding the Western Buddhist Order. I indeed took that responsibility upon myself, and it was indeed an onerous one. Nonetheless, there are times when, far from feeling that it was I who took on the responsibility, I feel that it was the responsibility that took on me. There are times when I am dimly aware of a vast overshadowing consciousness, and that's got a capital C, a vast overshadowing consciousness that has, through me, founded the order and set in motion our whole movement. Incredible words that are well worth pondering and well worth reflecting on. So speaking like this, speaking in this kind of way, in the way I've been talking and in relation to that quote, it makes it clear that the order is something that we're part of creating. We're part of something that's always going to be developing, that's continually going to be manifesting. You can either speak of it as developing or as manifesting. It's not, as I've said, an organisation, religious or ecclesiastical. Yes, we might have to do a certain amount of organising, but that's not essentially what it is. That's not what you will be joining. Even the language of joining is perhaps unfortunate. That's not the vision of the order. The order is an ideal in that Neoplatonic sense. It's the ideal, of course, of spiritual community. The ideal of committed individuals strenuously pursuing the Buddhist path in free association, in perfect harmony, and opening out to include others. This order requires continuous creation and recreation. It's a living thing, always unfolding, always changing. And certainly Bhante himself, from the very beginning, has been constantly opening up new dimensions of the order for us within the order and for those of you who want to join the order. Always pointing to new areas that we need to be aware of, that we need to develop. He's still doing it. He's still carrying on. I mean, the early days, You know, people would go off on a seminar, or they'd come up to see Bhante at Padmaloka, and, you know, over tea, Bhante would say things about the order, the implications of being an order member, of the spiritual life as we live it collectively. And they'd come back from these seminars or these, you know, cups of tea with Bhante or these meals with Bhante, and they'd be saying, well, you know, the latest thing is, you know, and there'd be this injection of a new sort of energy into the life of the order. And he's still doing it. You know, his recent communications on what is the Western Buddhist order, I suppose it'll have to be what is the Tri Ratna Buddhist order now. You know, and this point about the order is the disciples, is the order is made up of his disciples and the disciples of their disciples and so on. This isn't actually new. This is just bringing out something that he said before. Recently, he's renamed the order to reflect what we are more essentially, you know, making sure that the order East and West are fully unified in name. So he's continuing to explore the order and to inject that to us. But we're all involved in exploring the order. Of course, some people don't relate to this way of speaking. They even doubt the value of being part of an order. There are a lot of people, funnily enough, who get involved in our movement who don't like groups. They're not joiners, and they're very suspicious of groups. And they even say, well, you know, it's all very well talking about an order, but haven't you got a big danger then of just becoming a group, a cult, even worse? You know, ordination, going for refuge retreats, are sort of brainwashing sessions for cult members and so on. In any case, didn't the Buddha go it alone? He didn't need an order. What's all this talk about an order? Didn't he emphasise solitude, renunciation, dwelling in the forest, going it alone? Look at that verse in the Dhammapada. By you must the intense effort be made. The Buddha's only point the way. Fabulous line. Or what about that other one? Fare lonely as the rhinoceros. Or fare lonely as the rhinoceros horn is single. You know, avoid people. What about Milarepa? All those years in solitude. The image of Buddhism so often in the West can be of the solitary meditator, not in relationship. And I know some people have these kinds of lingering doubts, and even men who've asked for ordination have these sort of lingering doubts about the value of an order. And it's very important to sort these out before you're ordained. Very, very important to get to the bottom of these kinds of questions. It's not wrong for people to have these questions and these doubts. It doesn't mean you've got it wrong. They're very, very real questions. And it's much better not to sort of go along and think, oh, well, it'll go away later. It'll come out in the wash. I'll get ordained and everything will be all right and that'll go away. Well, it might not. You might get ordained and then these sorts of questions reassert themselves and they'll make your life and other people's much more difficult. So if you've got these kinds of lingering doubts, bring them right out. If there aren't these doubts, someone might say, well, okay, Sangha is important, but why a specific order? Why not something really loose? You know, we're just Buddhists, I go for refuge, you go for refuge, Dalai Lama goes for refuge, Thich Nhat Hanh goes for refuge, their disciples go for refuge, those Buddhists go for refuge. Why, you know, why bother with a particular order? Why not just meet, you know, and you're all Buddhists? That's all you need. We're all just Buddhists. We can all love each other as Buddhists and everything will be fine. Isn't that better, actually? Because then, you know, we'll all be together. Isn't a specific order, a particular lineage of teaching and practice with a particular ethos, just elitist, exclusive, worse, perhaps, intolerant? Well, actually, why not? Why bother with just Buddhists coming together? We can come together with anyone. Anybody can be Sangha. So why be so concerned about an order? People do have these doubts and these questions. You know, these are things I've heard over the years, and it's very, very important to go into them. So I'm going to try and address them in a particular way. It might not satisfy you if you have these doubts, but it's worth having a go. We need to go back. We need to go back to nothing less than the Buddha's enlightenment. And we need to understand more deeply the nature of that enlightenment. Because after all, that enlightenment is our spiritual ideal. We need to understand the nature of the Buddha, the enlightenment, the ideal of enlightenment, to which we go for refuge. And we all know that the Buddha's enlightenment is beyond all words, all conceptions. It's a deep and profound mystery. You know, our thoughts go up to it and then they just get burnt up. You know, if we can even get anywhere near to it. Yet we're fortunate that the Buddha did actually point to his enlightenment using words, using concepts, using images even. So we know that the Buddha's enlightenment involved seeing into the very depths of existence. Enlightenment is wisdom. Knowing, seeing things as they really are. And the essential description of seeing things as they really are is Pratitya Samuppada, conditioned co-production. Seeing this, the Buddha is liberated, is released, attains inconceivable freedom. So that's one aspect of the Buddha's enlightenment. But completely wedded to that is something else. Just as essential to the Buddha's enlightenment is others. We have unfolding out of the Buddha's insight into the true nature of things, that great vision of being seen with his Buddha eye. So again, a vision that is really incommunicable, a vision which the Buddha describes, attempts to communicate as all beings, all human beings, as being like different coloured lotus flowers growing in a muddy lake, pushing up out of the lake, out of the swamp of conditioned existence. Living beings are growing, pushing towards enlightenment. This is what the Buddha saw. And it's said that his compassion arose with this vision. His compassion for beings arose when he saw this. But we have to have a look at the real meaning of the word compassion here in the original language, which is anukampa, which means literally to tremble with, to shake with. So the Buddha's compassion is really his complete enlightenment, his perfect Buddhahood, trembling with the potential for enlightenment, the potential for Buddhahood in us, in all beings. So it's his actual, fully realized Buddhahood, trembling with our potential to attain enlightenment. Then that's the Buddha's love and compassion. And this vision of the Buddha of living beings as being like this, this trembling with all life, is as much an essential description of enlightenment as seeing Pratitya Samuppada. It's another way of seeing Pratitya Samuppada, actually. It's not just a vision, and the Buddha didn't then just have a sort of general love for humanity in the abstract. It became specific and concrete, because straight after the Buddha's vision of all beings as lotus flowers, straight after this experience of shaking with all life, he communicated what he'd seen. He communicated with those, with other people, with other beings. He befriended them. He became their Kalyanamitra. He wanted others to break out of ignorance, and he communicated with them until they broke out of ignorance. Do you remember the famous experience of the first of his disciples who got it, Kundanya? You know, the Buddha had to work quite hard to break through Kundanya's ignorance, but Kundanya saw. Eventually he saw. directly. And the Buddha was so inspired that somebody else could get his enlightenment, he just breathed forth the udana, Kondanya knows, Kondanya knows. And he started an order. He started an order by accepting disciples. The Buddha accepted disciples into an order. The original monk disciples, the ordination was very simple. Somebody would come to the Buddha, they'd be very impressed by his teaching, very moved by his teaching, maybe even see so deeply that they entered the stream. And they would say, I want to be your disciple. I wish to go forth under you. That's what, you know, I want you to be my teacher. And the Buddha would simply say, Ehi Bhikkhave, come Bhikkhu. He'd just name them as a Bhikkhu, name them as his disciple. Come Bhikkhu. That was the ordination. You also find early on people expressing their commitment in terms, of course, of going for refuge, whether monks or so-called lay people. This people committing themselves to enlightenment, to the teaching, to the Sangha, accepting the Buddha as their teacher, becoming his disciple, and accepting the other disciples of the Buddha as their fellows in the Dharma life. And quite quickly, a recognisable community emerged, a recognisable order emerged with its monastic dimension, its non-monastic, its lay dimension. In a way, in those days, it's quite simple and straightforward. It's quite clear. It was something, you know, very, very straightforward. You had the Buddha teaching. You had eventually his enlightened disciples teaching. You had the development of a Sangha, of an order, with different aspects to it, all over North India, the Middle Country, as it was called. And the Buddha had a lot to say about the order, about the way people should come together and practice together. He gave all sorts of teachings and practices, pointed to particular attitudes. And you do get the emergence of a sort of ideal community. But the point I'm trying to make here right from the beginning, remember I'm trying to answer questions about why have an order. The point I'm trying to make is that the Buddha did not remain in isolation. He did not remain in isolation, because essential to enlightenment is communication. It's absolutely essential. You cannot have an enlightenment without communication. You cannot have an enlightenment without love and compassion. You cannot have an enlightenment without friendship and friendliness. That's impossible. This is a point that Bhante brings out beautifully in his talk, The Case of Dysentery. Why did the Buddha have Ananda? Why did he have a companion? And he describes their relationship as a friendship. You know, and he draws, gives the different textual reasons why he's calling it a friendship. And he said, why is that? And he said, the traditional explanations are not satisfactory. You know, that the Buddha had a companion in the same way he had two chief disciples, in the same way that, you know, he, you know, went forth in a chariot, you know, as all Buddhas have done so he does so too. It's Dhammata. You know, he's keeping up sort of enlightened appearances. But he says, no, it's not that. It's actually because friendship, communication and friendship are essential to enlightenment. And he says, this relates to that very mysterious concept of Mahayana Buddhism of the Sambhogakaya. There's a dimension of Buddhahood. That's what kaya really means, a dimension of Buddhahood, where the enlightened being is in a state of constant mutual enjoyment with those who are enlightened and those who are on their way to enlightenment. There's always that dimension in a Buddha's experience, because there is no self and other in a Buddha's experience. So I've emphasised, if communication is essential to enlightenment, surely the path to it must involve that. If friendship and spiritual community are part of the Buddha's enlightenment, part of the Buddha's expression, That needs to be reflected in the path we take. Now, I've emphasised the need for spiritual friendship, learning from spiritual friends and living in harmony. The Buddha emphasised these things as much as he emphasised meditation. This is really important to bear in mind. We tend to think that the Buddha just taught meditation. He just taught the doctrine. That was the main thing. If you go through the Pali text, there is as much emphasis on friendship, on living in harmony, dwelling in harmony, and so on and so forth. And this emphasis derives from his vision of life, from his enlightenment. So we need to remember this. And I think we especially need to remember this. We are in a post-traditional world. In a traditional world, perhaps you don't need to emphasise those things so much. Perhaps because people are already so connected. But there seems to me, in this atomised world of ours, there are many, many pressures to reconceive the Buddhist life in individualistic terms. To reduce Buddhism to a set of techniques which you sort of give, but you don't really engage with people. You give and you go. Or to reconceive it where you're thinking exclusively in terms of me, my development, my insight, my meditation. You know, and getting other people to think very much in terms of me, me and my. In the end, that's self-defeating and Buddhism will die out. Of course, so we need to emphasise, I think, more than ever, the communication, the friendship, the community aspects of Buddhism. Of course, Buddhism developed. There have been all sorts of developments over the centuries. All sorts of traditions have developed. All sorts of lineages and cultures and ways of practicing. There are many different strands to Buddhism, and in the modern age, we can be aware of all of them. In days gone by, Buddhists in different countries following different lineages were barely aware of each other, weren't aware of each other at all. But now we can be aware of all of them, even sample all of them. What we don't always realise in our consumer culture, what we don't always realise is this, that in the East, in the traditional Buddhist East, it's understood. It was understood that if you were serious about following the path, you would need to find a teacher. You would need to find the disciples of a teacher with a particular approach. And you would need to get down to practicing that path with those people. Only a remarkable individual could take from here and there and make any sense of it. We have to admit that different Buddhist traditions, as they come to us, can seem diverse, contradictory, and confusing. Sooner or later, if you're serious, you need to place yourself near to a teacher. You need to be part of that teacher's community. The Buddha himself, after his enlightenment, this is an extraordinary episode in the Buddha's enlightenment, part and parcel of the Buddha's enlightenment. After his enlightenment, we find this extraordinary passage. It's a short sutta, the Gaurava Sutta, the reverent sutta. And the Buddha is reflecting, it's painful. The word is dukkha, it's painful. It's unsatisfactory for a man to live without someone to revere. Without someone to serve, without someone to dwell near, without someone to learn from. It gives us a real insight into the spiritual culture, the world, the very mature world that the Buddha came from. It's painful for a man not to have a teacher, not to have someone to look up to revere, to serve, to learn from, to practice with. It's painful. So the Buddha looked. you know, presumably with some divine eye or something, he looked and he saw that there was no one in the entire world who'd perfected sila, samadhi, prajna, and liberation. But nonetheless, he felt this need to revere. So he said, but I can revere the Dharma. That's what I will revere. That's what I will serve. Sangharakshita has done a very interesting commentary on this particular sutta. But somebody told me recently when they were pressing Bhante for a bit more of an insight into this incident. And he said, Bhante said, what the Buddha is revering is that in the universe which gives rise to Buddhas. That's what he's serving. And of course, that's what he did, because he taught the Dharma for the rest of his life. He made that Dharma, that in the universe which makes Buddhas possible to those who wanted it. So if a Buddha, you know, first of all starts thinking, where can I find a teacher? What about us? It suggests to me that need for a teacher, that need to revere, that need to serve someone, that need to revere somebody worthy of reverence and to have a training and a teaching is a deep human need. It's a deep human need. It's not just sort of culturally determined. And perhaps in the modern era, we are deeply alienated, profoundly alienated from that need. So yes, I would say you need an order. And by an order, I mean a particular lineage, you know, with a particular stemming from a particular teacher, giving a particular teaching, a particular training, a particular path, a particular arrangement of spiritual practices, communicating with a particular ethos, a particular culture, even a particular language, a particular vision. We enter into that kind of order, wherever we choose to find it, through that to the universal, to the great universal ideals of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. That's why Sangharakshita is nearest to us on the refuge tree. He's not there out of, it's not some sort of megalomania that he's, as it were, put himself there, or, you know, we haven't put him there because we regard him as a sort of god or something like that. It's just the facts. He's our gateway into the vast world of the Dharma, of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And if you don't feel this, and that's fine, if you don't like this, if you have doubts about this, as I've said, please be careful. Please be careful. Please check it all out. Please go right into it. Don't try to pretend that those doubts aren't there and go on and get ordained and then find that you're in real difficulty. Because we can't read your minds. You know, we can test you and ask you questions and see what's going on. But, you know, people can hide these things away. And we're not mind readers. It's in your own interest not to pretend, but to really get to grips with these things. Most order members, the vast majority of order members, see things in the way I'm describing them. They might not put it quite like that, but I'm very confident that most order members would agree with what I'm saying. So that's looking at why we have an order in principle. But why practically? Why do we need an order practically speaking? And again, I want to speak personally here. I want to go back to my ordination, which occurred quite a long time ago now. Ordination, the essence of ordination in our order, of course, is going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Ordination happens when your effective going for refuge is witnessed in the private ordination ceremony by a private preceptor, and when it's witnessed by your public preceptor in the public ordination, and you are accepted, you're received into the order. In my day, it was Bhante did both. We didn't even talk about private and public preceptors. There was just Bhante ordaining. And in those days, Bhante emphasised commitment very much. That was the language he used. Going for refuge is a commitment to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. It's, you know, good, strong language. And I wanted to commit myself to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. It was not enough for me that I thought I was a Buddhist. It wasn't enough for me that I felt that I was a Buddhist. It wasn't enough for me even that I was acting a little bit as a Buddhist. I wanted to declare myself as a Buddhist, loud and proud. I wanted to come out as a Buddhist, definitively decide to be a Buddhist with no going back. I wanted to give it full expression. And I wanted that seen and witnessed and acknowledged and accepted by those Buddhists I looked up to those people I respected, that I revered. So I asked for ordination. And in the ceremony, that is what happened. That going for refuge, that effective going for refuge, was seen. I felt that very strongly indeed. I felt in my private ordination, especially, that Bhante Sangharakshita took me completely seriously. In fact, looking back, he was taking my spiritual life even more seriously than I was taking it myself, which is a very unnerving experience, let me assure you. In the private ordination, you go alone to your private preceptor. And Bhante, at my private ordination, was very serious, solemn even. It was very weighty, deep. It was as if he didn't use this language, but the whole atmosphere, this isn't a game. This isn't a fantasy. This is what you really are. This is what it's really all about. And it was, for me, powerful, inspiring, energising, deeply disturbing. And at the public ordination, there was just a wonderful feeling of joy, of being accepted into the order. There were quite a lot of jokes and very, very light, a lot of love, friendliness, wonderful feeling of harmony and lightness. And I felt definitely received into a spiritual community, received by those I looked up to, received by those I looked up to. Very, very important to me. An ordination ceremonies really embody the essentials of what an order really is, ideally is. Within an order, within a spiritual community, that's what we do for one another. We witness and affirm each other's spiritual potential, each other's spiritual commitment, each other's endeavour, effort, struggle. We connect with, we shake with, to use that language, what is deepest in one another. It's why an order can be so spiritually vibrant. You know, our individual efforts, because they're really being seen and related to by others making individual effort, those efforts seem magnified and heightened and increased. You know, you can have that experience when you're meditating with other people, that it's a stronger experience of meditation. Something more vivid, more tangible is in the atmosphere. That's why, you know, doing pujas with others can be so strong. And this is why, as well, this sort of thing can be so challenging. Because, there's a demand to be authentic, to be real, to be true, because our spiritual potential is what is real in us and what is real in our spiritual friends, our brothers, our sisters in the Sangha. The only thing between us, it can seem sometimes, is the Dharma. You know, there's very little else we have in common. And we need this. We need to experience togetherness on this level. This isn't some neurotic need. It's not some sort of neurotic, needy state. Spiritual life is very, very demanding. Let's make no mistake, it is an individual life. We have to make, you know, individual effort. We've been talking in our own ordination team, which is, you know, our own little chapter, our own little kula, you know, about our own existential aloneness. We live together. We meet every day, yet we feel existentially alone with the great questions. Spiritual life is very demanding. It's so easy to slip back, to fall away, to delude oneself until stream entry, when you have an unconditioned going for refuge, a going for refuge that isn't dependent on any conditions at all, external conditions, including, by the way, you know, your body working, that sort of thing. Until stream entry, we need conditions to support our spiritual life. And as well as the conditions that we set up within ourselves with our own individual effort, we need others. We need others to instruct, to inspire, to criticise if necessary, others to confess to, people who, with whom we can express what is deepest in us, our deepest longings, our deepest inspirations, people who we can express our struggles to. It's so painful if what is deepest in you is ignored, if it cannot be seen, if it's overlooked, treated with cynicism. And it so often can be like this for us. So we need an order for these very obvious reasons. So the rest of this series of talks will be unpacking the different aspects of the order, from how to become an order member. Sadaloka will be, you know, taking us through the training for ordination. We're going to hear from Surata on the life of an order member, you know, what order members get up to. And Dharmadeepa is going to be talking to us about the order and the world. But for the rest of this talk, I want to talk about three key principles to the life of the order. First of all, individuality. Secondly, harmony. And thirdly, altruism. So first of all, individuality. In the early days, Bhante had a lot to say about what he called the true individual. You probably remember those old lectures, the individual, the group, and the spiritual community, and so on. And how you needed to be an individual to follow the Buddhist path. You have to follow it yourself. No one can do it for you. And you need to free yourself from the different manifestations of the group. So the first principle of the life of an order member is individuality, in the sense of individually committing yourself and following the path by yourself. And what this means is actually doing the practices, actually doing the work of spiritual development, individually practicing ethics, individually regularly practicing meditation, individually studying and reflecting on the Dharma, individually going on retreat, individually doing what you can to help others, what you can to help at the centre, what you can to work for the Dharma, and so on. But there's more, in a way, to individuality than that. In the old days, I think I was there when this came up, in an early order meeting, or in a seminar or something, we were asking Bhante, well, how can you tell whether somebody's ready for ordination? And Bhante said, well, what you're looking for is a reflection of the transcendental. And you thought, yeah, that's great, yeah. You know, and I was thinking, when I remembered this a few years ago, I thought, blimey, I sort of thought I knew what that meant at the time. It sounded so good, you know. There you are in a chapter meeting to somebody, has he got a reflection of the transcendental? But I think I can see what he's getting at. I've got more of a handle on it. I think what he's talking about is there the emergence of real faith, real Shraddha? Is there that intuition, that longing, that sense of the beyond in that person, that sense of enlightenment, that sense of bodhicitta, the will to wisdom and compassion, that sense of the order I've been talking about in the ideal sense? Is that there? Or is it still on, their involvement is still kind of on a mundane level, on a kind of ordinary level? It's all very worthy, or not, but is there that sense of something transcendent going on? That sense of the mystery. Very hard to put this into words, actually. It kind of gets embodiment, this particular way of talking, at the time of ordination, your private ordination. You're initiated into a mantra. your private preceptor witnesses, as it were, your individual direct connection with a particular symbolic form that embodies enlightenment. And he instructs you in the way you're going to meditate on that figure by talking to you how you're going to approach that. It might be a very elaborate visualization. It might be simple mantra recitation. But this dimension of the ordination is extraordinarily important because it is that connection. It's that connection with the transcendental, if you like. It's that golden thread with what's beyond. That really does have to be there. Is there a receptiveness to that, an openness to that higher dimension? Also, I think included here in this way of talking about individuality, is there respect for those more experienced, not trying to sort of decide beforehand who is more experienced, but an intelligent openness to those with more experience. So individuality then is a kind of vertical individuality. It's not sort of going out horizontally from the group. Is there an emergence up out of the group? Is there something beginning to stand above the habitual group pulls that's not so defined by those and connected with that higher dimension? In the private ordination, the whole symbolism of it is that you're willing to go it alone. You're so connected to that transcendental dimension. That faith is alive in you so much that even if nobody else was doing it, you would carry on going for refuge. And this is a very, very challenging point which all of us in the order itself now need to ask ourselves whether we are still up to that. And of course, one of the things this means is that are you willing to stand up for the principles of the order, even when everybody else, and I mean order members now, are actually going against it? Are you able to maintain your individual spiritual practice in really difficult conditions, as well as appreciating the importance of positive conditions? The near enemy of individuality, of course, is individualism. This can sort of, you know, we can sometimes masquerade as being individuals by reacting to the perceived group, to the supposed authority. Who do they think they are? Who does Sangharakshita think he is to tell me what the order is? We should decide it democratically. I'm an individual. I'm not doing what they say, etc., etc. Now, I've sort of made sort of fun of that. But, you know, there's a real tension here. I think there can be a real tension between all sorts of different pulls and forces. There's a tension between, as it were, between being authentic, in a way being ourself, for want of a way of putting it, and learning from those with greater experience. That can be a real struggle, and you can't work out, well, am I being truthful and genuinely, am I being a true individual? You know, am I following my conscience, or am I just reacting to these people? It can be a real struggle to sift all this through, and maybe this might be have something to do with previous experiences of groups, family, religious groups, schooling, or whatever. There's quite a lot to sort out there. It's these kinds of things when they come up. This is what commitment can throw up. If you don't commit yourself to anything, you never get near this stuff. It's the fact that you're committing yourself to a spiritual community, to a training, to Kalyana Mitrata, that these sorts of issues get thrown up. And it's an incredible sort of wrestling that goes on. The far enemy, of course, is passivity. Conforming, just going along with it and not really doing it. Even sometimes people can be making a lot of effort, but they're kind of just going along with it. And I've sometimes had the experience in the ordination process where I found with people there's something missing, somewhere they don't connect, and you have to ask the question. I remember this saying this quite graphically to somebody, I said, who was really going for ordination, but it wasn't happening. And I said, you have to think the unthinkable. And I've had more than one conversation like that. And they said, well, what's that? Maybe you've got to give up the ordination process, because you're not really doing it. There are other things you want to do. There are unresolved areas. Maybe you've got to take a real break from it. Maybe this thing that you think is absolutely central to your life actually isn't right now. And actually, it's been quite fruitful when people have done that. They've, you know, discovered eventually their real individual connection with things. So that's the first one, individuality. So then, harmony. All order members are committed to creating harmony. Deeper and deeper harmony between themselves and all other order members. They're committed to that because harmony is how an enlightened being, harmoniousness or being in harmony, is how an enlightened being is. Because an enlightened being has seen through the fiction of self and other, of me and you, the enlightened being, the Buddha says, is passionately fond of harmony. The enlightened being creates harmony, even in the face of disharmony and hostility. So essential to an order member's life is doing everything to create harmony, to deepen and strengthen harmony. And this must find practical expression. It can't just remain as a nice sentiment. It has to come into physical expression. So that means meeting regularly with other order members. You know, sometimes people say they want to be ordained, but I can't go to a chapter. I can't go on order weekends. I can't do this. I can't do that. Hey, what is it going to mean, you being an order member? You know, what on earth does it mean? What is your experience going to be of the spiritual community? You know, a practice? The fact that you've got a kesa and a funny name? Sangharakshita was so concerned about this some time back, he caused a bit of a stir in the order with a little aphorism of his. He said, I've coined a new aphorism. An order member not in a chapter is only half an order member. You know, and I remember being in a meeting of order members where some order members were really having a go at him for saying this. And he said, look, I'm trying to get you to think. There's no such thing as half an order member. You know, think about it. I'm trying to get you to think. We need to be in a chapter, of course, for our own sake, for obvious reasons. But it's more than that. You know, the obvious reasons of supportive conditions, but it's more to it than that. We need to be actively creating harmony with other order members. And when we're in a chapter, we're just order members. We're not there with any hat on. We're not a chairman. We're not a mitra convener. We're not a preceptor. We're not a teacher. We're not a class leader. You know, I remember somebody once in the ordination process who'd, you know, was a bit of a sort of teacher himself. He was saying that, well, you know, when I'm in a chapter, I'll be the teacher. And I said, I'm sorry, you've really missed the point of what the order is. Even Sangharakshita isn't a teacher, in a sense, in a chapter meeting, in an order member. He's in an order meeting. He's just there with us. Any teaching naturally arises. Then there's, as well as chapters, there's order weekends, you know, where we, you know, every few months we meet together, all the order members in a particular country meet together in good large numbers. You're getting a connection with the wider order. Then there's international conventions. It's even wider than that. You know, realising the order is much, much bigger, much deeper than our own particular sort of pool of the order, our own version, our little pocket of the order, so to speak. So that all these things build harmony, create harmony. Harmony in the world, very positive for the world. And then, of course, there's things like order retreats. There's lots of order retreats these days, focusing on different aspects of an order member's life. There's, of course, individual friendships, all these things. And then, of course, there's taking great care with our speech in our group this morning, quite a few people talked about that their main working ground was speech. So as well as, you know, there's truthful speech, kindly speech, useful speech, but of course harmonious speech, or as Bounty describes it in the Ten Pillars, harmonising speech. Harmonising speech, speech which draws people together, which brings people together in deeper harmony. Even our meditation practices and our study and these sorts of things are for the sake of harmony. You know, every month there's a practice called the Ordo Metta Bhavana, where order members around the world on a sort of time continuum develop metta for all other order members. This came out of one of Sangharakshita's experiences in solitary retreat, where he had a vivid sense of the order. A vivid sense of the order. The order was quite small then, but he had a vivid spiritual sense of the order, and out of that came this practice called the Ordo Metta. Sangharakshita was once asked, why is it so important that order members keep up their meditation on their chosen deity, meditation on their sadhana? And his reply was, for the unity of the order. Really, really striking. You'd think that practice, well, it's so that, you know, I can unite with the deity, develop the qualities for enlightenment. No, the unity of the order. And the reason for that, he said, was because if all order members were doing that, they would be evoking, they would be in touch with their private ordination. They would be in touch with what is most essential to them as order members. And if all order members were doing that, there would be a tremendous unification within the order, a spiritual unification. The near enemy of harmony, of course, is collusion. Pretending that there's no differences when there really is. You know, sitting there grinning like monkeys, but there's great big elephants under the carpet. Or that rather blocked, sort of stuffy kind of energy, and you know that there's sort of energies cancelling each other out. There's all this sort of psychic activity, so that, you know, you just, you know, you can't get anywhere. There's no it's pretend nicey nicey sometimes, or just very very dull. Well, that's the near enemy. That's not true harmony. That's something else. And the far enemy, of course, is disharmony, conflict, mutual ill will, which is very very painful when it occurs in the order. It's particularly upsetting. It's particularly upsetting when that happens. And it does happen, you know, and it will happen because people, we're not perfect. You know, we're not enlightened beings. So, you know, there are fallings out and tensions and so on. But it's particularly upsetting because it seems to go right against what we're committed to. And when it happens, we must do all that we can to heal it. And to not feed it. Do all that we can to not speak badly of other order members in the presence of people who have disputes with those order members. We really have to do a lot of work. Bhante's vision of what harmony means, essentially in principle, is found in a very early lecture, a pre-founding of the order lecture, The Meaning of Conversion of Buddhism in Buddhism. And he does a kind of summary of it in the history of my going for refuge. I think this is fantastic. Just listen to this. So he's talking about what it means about the Sangha being together. The together lay in communication, which was not just an exchange of ideas, but a vital mutual responsiveness on the basis of a common spiritual ideal and a common spiritual principle. It was a common exploration in complete harmony and complete honesty of the spiritual world. In this way, spiritual progress takes place. So a vital mutual responsiveness on the basis of a common spiritual ideal and a common spiritual principle. It's a common exploration in complete harmony and complete honesty of the spiritual world. In this way, spiritual progress takes place. Could do a lot to, well worth unpacking that. Thirdly, the third principle is altruism. Nearly finished. So order members have a duty to individually go for refuge. to follow the path, to create sangha. They have a duty to create and to deepen harmony, deeper levels of harmony. I'm saying these are duties that we need to take up, vows even that we need to take. But there's a third duty, altruism, generosity, giving. In particular, communicating the Dharma to those who don't have it. If you have experience, communicating your greater experience to those with less experience. Again, altruism in this sense is essential, it's intrinsic to spiritual life. It's often said that dana, generosity, sharing, when that's really happening, that's the first real sign of real spiritual progress. It means that you're less wrapped up in yourself. Your self-view is loosening. You're genuinely opening out to others and for others. And the Buddha is very clear in the seventh of his conditions for the growth of the order about the kind of attitude that there should be within the order. There should be an attitude, a mindfulness of dwelling in harmony and welcoming others and going out to others to join in that harmony that the order has. And especially going out to others by sharing the Dharma with them, enabling others to practice the Dharma and to benefit from the Sangha. Not necessarily teaching. I don't think it's a good idea for people to start thinking, I'm going to be a teacher. I think that can be very dangerous. At first, doing everything you can to support those who can teach, who do teach. And the generosity, the altruism happens because you've experienced the benefits of the Dharma and the Sangha. And you want to share those benefits with others who don't have it. Sometimes people don't feel this, but the people are there and they need it. So you need to forget about yourself and you need to respond. You know, it really can be like that sometimes. I mean, to be frank, I mean, sometimes I don't feel like doing a Going for Refuge retreat. You've all turned up, talk to write, group to take. I'm not feeling in a very good mood. And, you know, what am I going to do? Follow my feelings? And, you know, Lokeshwara is going to say, oi, these people have paid good money. You know, you can't walk away. You can't do that. You've just got to turn up and get on with it and open up, you know, to, you know, people's needs. And, of course, then you start enjoying yourself and all the rest of it. I mean, that's very often my experience. Left to myself, I'd live a completely lazy and self-centred existence, probably listening to the radio and music and reading crime novels and all the rest of it. So I'm very, very grateful that you come here because you give me an opportunity to really sort of, you know, open up and all the rest of it, bring out the best. The near enemies of, yeah, so, you know, sometimes if you don't feel like it, so what? Feelings, what are they? Don't worry about it. Just get on and help. I'm sure there's a near enemy to what I've just said there. The near enemies of altruism are, of course, sentimental pity. Feeling all caring and sharing, using lots of words of caring, but not actually really benefiting others. Not really sharing, shaking with their spiritual potential, almost wanting to keep them sick. You know, and being all that sort of strokey kind of thing. There's a lot of language around at the moment, I've noticed, that's all sort of, you know, it's all the language of caring and all the rest of it. But it's words, you know, where's the reality of engagement? Perhaps as well, you know, we can do lots of good, worthy things, you know, in all sorts of social ways, but having no time to communicate the Dharma. Well, why is that? Why is that? Maybe we're not recognising that it's the Dharma that is really very, very badly needed. That it's the Sangha, it's an order of serious spiritual practitioners that's really needed. That's what's really needed. It might be very slow to bring about change, but something will really last if we do that. And we can pass it on to the generations that follow us. You know, so many people get worked up about so many issues, but the really deep dukkha is often not engaged with. There's also, of course, the problem of burnout. You know, as soon as you talk about altruism and serving and giving and all the rest of it, people say, hang on, what about burnout? I know all the members who've burnt out, you know, and got in a terrible state. There's something wrong with the whole idea of altruism. Well, my answer to that is, whenever I've got near to burnout, it's because I've been incredibly lazy. It's because I've been incredibly lazy. I've been running around doing all sorts of worthy things, but I've been neglecting what is deepest. I've been neglecting my inspiration, neglecting my spiritual practice, neglecting real spiritual friendship. It's not that I need a rest. It's actually what I need is serious, deeper engagement with that, the archetype of the order. That's when I've got near to burnout, when I've neglected that, and I've just been rather compulsively running around like the proverbial headless chicken, thinking that I'm doing good and huffing and puffing and sort of showing how selfless and what a bodhisattva I am. Ego trip. The far enemy, of course, is selfishness. Just everything gets focused on yourself. Banti described this as a sort of syndrome years ago. I remember in a seminar in 76, not long after I was ordained, the front lounge was the venue for this seminar, Mind in Buddhist Psychology. I could show you the exact spot where he was saying it. He talked about pseudo-spiritual aestheticism. There's a phrase. Pseudo-spiritual aestheticism. Not asceticism, aestheticism. He says, well, you're overly concerned with your state, with your comfort, with, you know, your pain, your dhyana, your meditation, you know, refining and refining, you feeling better all unto yourself, completely ignoring that the floor needs to be swept, somebody needs a cup of tea, somebody's hungry, a centre needs to be run and things like that. And he said, somebody said, well, where does that lead, that pseudo-spiritual aestheticism? Nowhere. It's a complete dead end. So don't do that. I'm sure you don't. So these are the three principles, the three duties to keep in mind: individual spiritual effort, harmony, altruism. I've said right at the start that the order is in creation, in constant creation and recreation. And, you know, I know sometimes in talking like this, people can often feel, crikey, that's a bit much. Well, it is a bit much. And it is a bit much for us in the order, let me assure you. You know, the order is not a perfect place by any means. But it is, you know, a place where a process is happening. As my dear friend Arloka says, you know, it's a mess in progress. But it is in progress. It's not just a mess. So, you know, it's challenging for us all. Yes, it's always emerging. It's always descending, perhaps, to use that language. Banti's vision of the order, he says the symbol of the order, is nothing less than the 11-headed and 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara, the Lord who looks down, the Bodhisattva of Mahakaruna, great compassion, Mahakarunika itself, the great compassion that is the expression of voidness, that is the expression, that is the efflorescence of wisdom. And you all know that wonderful story of this great ascetic. I have to remember this. Avalokiteshvara was a yogi ascetic. Yeah, that black antelope skin that he wears. You know, he didn't kill the antelope. You know, sure, he found it. But, you know, that's what the ascetics wore. He's very gentle, you know, symbolising his gentleness. And, you know, he worked and worked and worked to benefit others, took the great bodhisattva vow, even took a vow in front of his teacher, the great red Buddha Amitabha, that if for a moment I think about my own welfare, of just going it alone, may my head shatter, may my body break up into 1,000 pieces. And he worked and worked and worked to benefit others. You know, he was really going for it, you know, individual spiritual practice and doing everything he could to benefit others. And then he looked out and saw so little was achieved. hardly anything was achieved. And just for a second he thought, oh well, why bother? I'll just get into that pseudo-spiritual aestheticism. I'm sure he didn't think that, but anyway. And of course, the vow kicked in. Condition co-production. You make a vow, something's going to happen. And sure enough, his head shattered into 10 pieces. His body shattered into 1,000 pieces. And of course, it was unbelievably painful. This splitting, this breaking, this death. This terrible spiritual failure, this terrible disaster, this terrible humiliation, this explosion. But then Amitabha, he called on Amitabha, his teacher, a great longing, you know, nothing else to do but to call on that higher dimension. And Amitabha said, well, everything comes about independent upon conditions. And magically, extraordinarily, Amitabha rearranged this shattered being into a being with 1,000 arms reaching out to benefit everyone, and with 11 heads to look in every single direction, even placing, you know, a kind of figure of his own head on the very top to remind him of his teacher. Blazing white in colour, incandescent white light this form took. And the two hands at the centre that Avalokiteshvara holds in the Anjali Mudra is holding the clear, wish-fulfilling jewel, which is the embodiment of the bodhicitta, the mind of emptiness and great compassion, the very heart of the order. That's the very heart of our order. And yes, there are all those 1,000 arms. Some forms of Avalokiteshvara are said to have 100,000 arms. All reaching out and yet all in perfect harmony with one another. So this form, this really rather bizarre form, is of course a symbol, a showing, an attempt to show a particular kind of consciousness. Well, it's an attempt to show the order in the highest and the deepest sense, the order that we're attempting to manifest.